Welcome to this Touch podcast activity that has been recorded for Touch Oncology. This podcast aims to bring you expert perspectives from a multidisciplinary team on the clinical challenges associated with paroxysmal nocturnal hemoglobinuria, or PNH. Specialists in the multidisciplinary team involved in caring for patients with PNH share their perspectives on the clinical presentation and diagnosis of PNH, explain the benefits and limitations of current and emerging complement inhibitor therapies for PNH, and discuss the impact of PNH on patients' quality of life. Financial support for this medical educational activity has been provided to Touch IME by an educational grant from Novartis. In this podcast, a primary care physician and a hematologist are joined by a patient with PNH and discuss the signs and symptoms of PNH and how these inform the clinical diagnosis.
Hello, my name's Dr. Will Evans. I'm a general practitioner in Leeds in the United Kingdom and an academic at the University of Nottingham. Today, I'm delighted to have with me Professor Regis Pifford de la Tour, who's a professor of hematology at the Hematology and Bone Transplant Centre at St. Louis Hospital in Paris, France. And also, I'm delighted to have with us Jess Rutcliffe, who's a patient living with PNH. In this section, we will cover the topic recognizing and referring patients with PNH. So to start, Regis, perhaps you could give me a little bit of an overview of paroxysmal nocturnal hemoglobinuria.
Yes, thank you very much, and hi, everybody. So basically, PNH is a rare chronic acquired blood disease. This is not the cancer, as the prevalence is about 1 to 2 patients per million individual worldwide. It's an acquired mutation which is occurring in a gene that is called PIGA and that is acquiring in hematopoietic stem cells. So basically, each gene is responsible for the synthesis of complement inhibitors that are placed at the cell surface. And of course, if there is these troubles, then your cells are not able to inhibit the complement, which is constitutively and always activated throughout our life, protecting us against infection. And if you cannot inhibit, then the complement is destroying your cells and coming to what we call hemolysis for red cells. And all those destructions are also associated with clots, which is outstandingly severe for our PNH patients because this is associated oftenly with death. The other thing that we have to know about this disease is that she's not appearing in everybody. You have to have an acquired bone marrow failure disorder behind, which comes to the triad, hemolysis, thrombosis, and bone marrow failure. So all patients are not presenting the cells. They are all eunuch. And the presentation basically is on two sides. You have some patients who are mainly presenting with bone marrow failure. It's about 2/3 of the patients, and the treatment will be the treatment of aplastic anemia. And on the other side, you have the patients who are presenting mainly with hemolysis, needing some complement inhibition. And this is mainly about those patients that we're going to speak today. In the middle, you have some patients that you cannot classify, that are in the middle and will go to one side to another during their life.
Thank you, Regis. That's fascinating that there's such a variability within such a rare disease as well. Jess, as a person who lived with PNH, I'm interested to hear, how did you initially present?
That's a good question. And I don't know exactly, because a lot of the time, actually this right now is the first time that I'm learning fully about the depths of PNH, but my initial diagnosis was sort of pinpointing towards initially an iron deficiency, but also there was a bone marrow biopsy as well, which was possibly the most painful thing I've experienced to date. So I feel there was that exploration on both sides, but from my understanding, within the PNH that I have, I'm less likely on like the blood clot side. So I feel like it's possibly pointing towards the hemolysis side. But for me, it was all down to having a sore throat that just wouldn't shift. And so I think that also then ties to the compromised immune system and actually being on antibiotics and then penicillin that wouldn't tackle it. And that kind of was the starting pull of the thread to discover ultimately that I had PNH once it was something that was tested for.
Okay, yeah. Thanks, Jess. So obviously there's significant variation in how they present. So I think kind of thinking as a GP, as a primary care practitioner, are there any key symptoms, Professor De La Tour, that we as primary care practitioners should be looking out for?
Yes, that's a very good question. And that's something we are always exchanging with GPs, because most of the time when the patient, they're coming to them, they are not doing the diagnosis straightforward, because this is not specific symptoms. This is very hard. And when it came to the discussion of the diagnosis, and when they got diagnosed, then they culpabilize, saying, wow, should I have think about this before? I mean, just to give a general overview, a GP will see 1 to 2 PNH in an entire professional life. So this is extremely rare. So I would say that some things that are really typical, it's the outstanding abdominal pain with nothing behind. You don't have any inflammation or abnormalities through echography or scanner. The exams are quite normal, but the pain is outstandingly high. That's possibly something related to PNH. Thrombosis, of course, especially in young patients, when you don't have any cancer or predisposition that might explain this. Dark urine is also something that is could evolve the diagnosis. But the other symptoms, I mean, usually nausea, fatigue, small pains, all those things are not typical. So I would say yes, the abdominal pain, the dark urines, and patients who are constantly recurring this kind of signs might be something you are thinking about. And obviously, if you have abnormalities on the CBCs, especially hemolytic anemias with those clinical signs, of course, it makes you more easy to think about.
Yeah, no, that's great. So I think, yeah, you've touched there on one of my questions. You know, obviously, as you say, patients present with potentially quite variable clinical features. Are there other tests that you would recommend doing in primary care?
Yeah, basically, I would say that an acute abdominal pain in such a patient should go to ultrasound to eliminate thrombosis. For GPs who are diagnosing PNH, or for GPs who are following patients with PNH, this is really the fear that we have. So any sign that makes you think about a thrombosis, you should go to ultrasound scanner very easily with those patients, because this is something that we are all keeping in mind. For the rest, I guess that a well-done CBCs looking for hemolysis is enough. And then we go for the diagnosis, and this is very cheap. It's a flow cytometry. We are not screening genes, because there is no genetic recurrence in this disease. It can be mutations, it can be deletions, it can be many genetic abnormalities. So we are just looking for those inhibitors at the cell surface, and especially on white cells, because the red cells, as I told you before, can be destroyed. So you can miss the diagnosis if you're looking on red cells. Adjust the flow cytometry in white cells, namely neutrophils and monocytes. This is very easy to do. This is cheap. And you can have the diagnosis in one day. And all hematological centers, even in the city, I mean, a common lab can do it. So flow cytometry is the main diagnostic tool that will say to you if your patient has PNH or no.
That's great. Thank you. Thank you, Reggie. It certainly highlights to me that, you know, that's a very interesting about the abdominal pain and some of these nonspecific symptoms, looking for the hemolysis, and then moving on to, as you say, a readily available test in hematological centers. There is, like many rare diseases, a significant diagnostic delay. Jess, in your experience, did you identify kind of potentially missed opportunities for diagnosis?
It's a good question. I think so, because it was almost over time, and it was about sort of a 12-month journey from initial investigation to diagnosis of PNH. I think there was a lot of the symptoms that I now know to be signals of PNH that were happening on their own. And I never, as a patient, I never connected them together to say, go to my GP and identify that I was feeling really fatigued or that I was having sort of a bit of a brain fog time. Because I think unless you know how you should be feeling, you don't always know when you're not quite feeling 100%, especially being the age that I was when I was diagnosed, which was 25. I don't think I would have experienced fatigue as I know it now and been able to sort of say, this is something I'm experiencing and attach it with, say, something else that maybe then would point to PNH. But really trying with an initial signal to kind of look for the others, which for me, I don't feel that was really done until the latter part of my diagnosis journey, sort of more towards actually testing my blood for certain signals of PNH, which is what led to the diagnosis. It all felt a little bit kind of sporadic, looking for different things rather than looking at it perhaps as like the full picture. But then I think because it is so rare and not something that is immediately tested for, that in itself is quite hard to kind of fit those two together. So rather than testing everybody if they show signs of fatigue, more often than not, that fatigue probably won't be a signal of PNH, but in some of those cases it will be. And so for me it was almost, how can you look for the signals as a whole, even in somebody that might not sort of be the kind of classic patient of PNH, which at the time I was sort of told that I wasn't at the age that I was.
Yeah, no, absolutely, Jess. And yeah, thank you, that's a really, you know, really powerful to hear your own personal story of this. I think, yeah, so a take home from me would be that, you know, when there is clinical suspicion, and as you say, it presents, can present with a range of different clinical features and can be quite nonspecific, but to work down that path, and when you notice a hemolytic anemia, and potentially look for that in a broader range of patients, then onward referral to hematology and then a readily available test of flow cytometry is key for establishing the diagnosis. So I'd like to just take this opportunity to thank you both, Jess and Regis, for a really fascinating conversation. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank you. Take care.
Thank you for listening to this Touch podcast. You can access more content on this topic on Touch Oncology at www.touchoncology.com. Don't forget, there are two other chapters in this series, so please listen in for further insights from the multidisciplinary team.